Hey guys, welcome to American 2. This is a unit on imperialism, and imperialism is defined as the idea that it's okay for whatever reason, religious, economic, political, to go into another country and take that country over, to make a colony of that particular country for the mother country's own purposes. And imperialism was something that the United States was kind of late in the game on. Other countries, most notably the British, the French, the Dutch, and the Germans, had been carving out places in Asia as well as Africa and the Caribbean to basically develop colonies of their own. And that's imperialism. So remember, imperialism defined is the idea that one country goes into another in an effort to colonize that particular country for economic, political, social reasons. Okay? And so you want to remember that the United States was a little bit late in the game to this because, you know, chiefly American foreign policy, and let's talk about foreign policy for a minute. A foreign policy is the way that you deal with other countries, or your philosophy about how you, you know, protect yourself in the world socially, economically, politically, and how you relate to those other countries in the world. If you remember from American 1, one of America's chief foreign policy mantras was isolationism. Remember that George Washington had said in his farewell address that the United States shouldn't be big on two things. The United States should not be big on political parties at home and shouldn't be big on entangling alliances in the world. And so by and large, the United States had followed, since George Washington up to the late 1800s, a general policy of isolationism. So you might have a question on your final exam that says something like, hey, you know, what was this early foreign policy? And you want to remember that it's isolationism. But we're going to see that change in the decade of the last decades of the 1800s. One of the things just to think about was that, remember in 1823, that President Monroe had given a call for the United States to defend the Western Hemisphere against European colonies, against having no more European colonies in the Western Hemisphere. Remember that speech, that part, was written by John Quincy Adams, his Secretary of State. So as we move into our unit on imperialism, think about two things. Generally, American foreign policy had been isolationist. We did not want to get involved in foreign affairs of other countries, but also after the Monroe Doctrine is issued, particularly after the 1850s, when it comes to be called the Monroe Doctrine, the Western Hemisphere is going to be an important place of influence for us to try to restrict the number of countries making colonies there, but also it's going to be the American Hemisphere. It's going to be a place to be defended. It's going to be a place where Americans mediate disputes, okay, between different countries. All right, imperialism. It's a policy of taking colonies. A lot of times it's economic. Remember, through the Gilded Age, the United States had raised a lot of businesses, had produced a lot of goods, and what we were doing is we were now in a situation where we needed to find more places for raw materials for the making of goods. We also needed to find places to sell our goods as we expanded in the world. Remember at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893, the historian / sociologist Frederick Jackson Turner had said that the West, remember he's using the 1890 census to determine that the West is closed, that the frontier as it was closed, and now Americans were out, in some ways, looking for a new frontier. One of the words you want to know is jingoism, and that's an hilarious feeling. That's a feeling of progress. That's a feeling that you're doing right. And jingoism was often expressed by a guy by the name of Reverend Josiah Strong. And he will write a book around this time called Our Country Right or Wrong. That's a really good expression of jingoism. Hey, it's our country, right or wrong. We're doing this, you know, because we can, because we have something to offer. So remember that the U.S. needed new markets for goods. And when you think about new markets, think about spheres of influence, you know, places in the world where America could go trade and benefit from that trade. So let's get into imperialism here and think a little bit about it. You know, two of your American leaders who supported imperialism, supported this idea of America having a special purpose, special destiny, you know, we might say American exceptionalism here, were William McKinley, president in 1896 and 1900, and Theodore Roosevelt, assistant secretary of the Navy in the late 1890s, and then later vice president under McKinley in 1900. And when McKinley is shot in 1901, it will be the damn cowboy, Teddy Roosevelt, as he was called by some, who eventually will become president. Two folks who were not for imperialism, were not for America going in and taking colonies and dealing with other people, were the industrialist Andrew Carnegie, the steel baron, and the writer Mark Twain. Mark Twain had traveled the world in the last 4 years of the 1800s, the last 4 years of the 19th century, and he had seen how people who had colonized certain areas, most notably the Dutch in South Africa, how they treated the native peoples. And so in the late 1800s and early 1900s, Mark Twain wrote a lot against this idea of imperialism. Remember that Carnegie believed in the gospel of wealth, in sharing resources to help different peoples. He wasn't necessarily for going in militarily and taking someplace over. You know, that kind of went against his idea. In 1867, William Seward, the Secretary of State, purchased Alaska from Russia. Everybody thought this was a joke. And so they called it Seward's Folly. Today we know it's anything but a joke. Today it's part nature reserve, part pipeline, and it's a strategic stronghold in the world against Russia itself. In 1898, it had been tried several times before, but most notably in 1898, the United States will annex Hawaii. Hawaii was an important territory for sugar, and also as a place to coal to refuel the U.S. Navy. And so this important sugar and coaling area is going to be annexed by the United States in 1898. You may walk through the grocery store and see Dole pineapple or some other kind of fruit that is in the Dole can. Sanford Dole was a instrumental figure in helping to annex Hawaii. Alfred Thayer Mahan was a gentleman who had written a book. It's still in print, which tells you that it's remained significant. But Alfred Thayer Mahan was a naval officer in the United States, and he wrote a very important book called The Influence of Sea Power Upon History. You know, this is a time in world history where people are thinking about empires. So Alfred Mahan's central idea in The Influence of Sea Power Upon History was, hey, if any country is going to have the potential to become and maintain an empire, they needed a strong navy. The Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Teddy Roosevelt, really bought into this idea. And it was in the 1880s that the United States moves itself from a wooden navy to a steel navy, a navy that's going to be coal-fired, that's going to be more modern. And so the United States will increase its number of battleships. And that'll be an important story for us as we go through this information. I want to talk to you for a couple minutes about the Spanish-American War, the splendid little war, as it comes to be called. Well, you know, there were some causes for the Spanish-American War, and one was yellow journalism, sensational stories coming out of Cuba. Cuba was attempting to have a revolution from Spain. And, you know, Spain represented their imperial leaders, and Cuba was trying to have their own revolution, to have independence from Spain, much like the British colonists had a revolution to gain their independence from England. Yellow journalism, or sensational stories, fueled very heavily by the Hearst Network, led by William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer, you know, the Pulitzer set of newspapers. Both of these gentlemen had newspaper hubs in New York, and they're publishing stories all the time. These stories were sensational, meaning that some were true and some were not. And William Randolph Hearst was rumored at one point to say of the Cuban revolutionaries, hey, you provide the pictures and I'll provide the war. So, you know, this was about selling newspapers. This was about competing with a rival to sell a greater number of newspapers, and sensational stories helped to do this a lot. So when the Spanish, for example, put some Cuban families and Cuban revolutionaries in concentration camps, you know, behind wire, El Concentrados, as they were called, this makes big news, particularly in Florida, you know, barely 90 miles away from Cuba. And the American people are becoming very sympathetic to the Cuban revolutionaries, and many start urging the government to do something. Another cause for the Spanish-American War is something called the DeLome Letter, D-E-L-O-M-E, the DeLome Letter. This was a letter from a Spanish official kind of cracking on Mr. McKinley. You know, so here's a Spanish diplomat smearing the president's name, and that didn't sit well with a lot of Americans. As the fighting, as the conflict in Cuba gets a little more robust, the United States will send a battleship, the USS Maine, to Havana Harbor just to monitor the situation. And in early 1898, there's an explosion, and the USS Maine is sunk to about the number of 200-plus American lives being lost. Immediately, William Randolph Hearst, particularly Joseph Pulitzer, they get involved, and the Americans will accuse Spain of blowing up the Maine. Spain calls out the United States for possibly blowing up their own ship to start a war. What does Assistant Secretary of the Navy Teddy Roosevelt do? He cables the Pacific Fleet. He orders them to, you know, attack Manila Bay, and then the government will urge President McKinley to declare war, which he will eventually do. And so the cries go out, much like remember the Alamo. The cries go out to remember the Maine. If you ever have a chance, go to Arlington National Cemetery, and you'll leave the Veterans Amphitheater, where the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier is, and where Veterans Day program is held every November, and you'll walk up a slight rise, you'll pass the monument to the Challenger 7, the space shuttle astronauts who were killed in 1986, but you'll walk up to a little memorial to the USS Maine, and you'll see a mast, you'll see a bell, you'll see the wheel of the battleship. And it's quite a gorgeous monument. You know, what really happened, and National Geographic will finally do a study by reviewing the earlier studies that were done. And we know today that the USS Maine blew up because the coal that was being stored to move the ship, to power the ship, there was ammunition stored nearby. And most probably what ended up happening was that the coal dust ignited in the coal bunker, and then the fire spread to the ammunition, leading to an explosion. So your splendid little war will be heightened by an accident. And what will it do? It will help to move America to, that accident will help to move America to a world power. You know, William McKinley is not, earlier on, is not for war. And there'll be a story later on where William McKinley said that he was so troubled by this decision about whether or not to go to war in Cuba against Spain that he, you know, spends some sleepless nights walking the White House. And finally he just comes to a decision that it's the right thing to do. So, upon order by Assistant Secretary of the Navy Teddy Roosevelt, Commodore George Dewey will take the Philippines. And what it will begin is a fierce battle called a banana war in the Philippines. But freedom fighter Emilio Aguinaldo in the Philippines and his band will help the United States defeat the Spanish in the Philippines. Commodore Dewey, as far as the Navy goes, it'll take 30 minutes or less to defeat the Spanish Navy in Manila Bay. And Manila Bay will become an important, again, coaling and fueling station for the American military. Later on, unfortunately, we will put Emilio Aguinaldo under house arrest, and there'll be a Filipino insurrection from 1898 to roughly 1901, and eventually the Philippines will gain its independence from the United States in 1946. I always tell my students that's a long time to wait for independence, 1898 to 1946. But a war in the Philippines like this, or a war in Cuba, or a war in other parts of the Caribbean during this time, Nicaragua, good example, they'll be called the banana wars, not necessarily because they're fought over bananas, but they're fought in these different climates of, you know, Asia or the Caribbean. So, you know, something to think about. Not everybody supported the Spanish-American War. There'll be a strong anti-imperialist league led by Andrew Carnegie. Okay, but again, the newspapers, yellow journalism, will support the war. Teddy Roosevelt will resign from his post as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and he will join a group called the Rough Riders, a cavalry unit that will fight in Cuba. And Teddy Roosevelt will be famous for the charge of the Rough Riders up San Juan Hill. It's important to note that Kettle Hill, a nearby hill, was captured by the Buffalo soldiers, the black troops that are fighting in segregated units. They can't be integrated with the white troops. And so as Kettle Hill is captured, it paves the way for Teddy Roosevelt, who did fight wonderfully with his buddies, Native Americans, former buddies from Harvard Law School, Rough Riders. These were guys from all across the country, and they will do very well in charging up San Juan Hill. Later on, the very famous artist Frederick Remington will do a drawing of the Rough Riders fighting at San Juan Hill. You know, this is called the Splendid Little War, the Spanish-American War. It lasts 3 months. That's a good thing. We might say, just based on that alone, that, yeah, okay, you know, things did go splendidly. It was a short war. There were not a lot of casualties, per se, comparing the deaths of Americans in World War II at 440,000 plus, and then comparing the deaths in the Spanish-American War, much, much, much less. The American gains from the Spanish-American War will be Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines. So America begins to gain territory. You know, the big question, by the time of the Treaty of Paris in 1898, 3 months after America goes to war with Spain, is what to do with these people in the Philippines? What to do with these people in Guam? What to do with these people in Cuba? What to do with these people in Hawaii? You know, do they become citizens? Does the United States become a protectorate of these places? Eventually, Puerto Rico will be considered a protectorate of the United States. Hawaii will be annexed, later to be made a state by 1959, but still, that's a long way away. And then what to do with Cuba? You know, Cuba had revolted against Spain, but now they had kind of inherited the United States. So what's the United States going to do with Cuba? And then, you know, eventually what's the United States going to do with the Philippines? And I already shared that it's going to be a while, 1946, before the Filipino peoples become independent. So in our next 15 minutes or so, we're going to talk about America as a world power. And America will be encouraged more and more to become a world power because of a poem that's released by one of the greatest British writers in world history the year after the Spanish-American War ends in 1899.